Hi. This is the Green Antler.
So that's the life history phase we're talking about. This is in an area that is presumably perhaps less critical in a sense, but at the same time, it's also the life history period when we have the lowest certainty with respect to what the how many fish survive, as David Welch likes to talk about. So we've got three presentations. We'll start with David Welch, then I'll give a short presentation, and then we'll have Mark Saunders speak. And once again, I think we should restrict questions after each of these presentations to points of clarification. And then after the three speakers, we can open it up. And just to think about what we're hoping to speak about, I mean, I think we should be trying to keep in mind what are the primary knowledge gaps, you know, during this extended life history period, and what kind of future work can we recommend to address these information gaps. And I think this will kind of lead into the final piece on the agenda, which is kind of next steps. And so, Mark, we can decide whether we want to sort of wrap up this following the fish session, you know, at 3 o'clock and then take a break, or whether the following fish session would continue. I think we can play that by ear. But I sort of see this session leading into the next step discussion. And for next steps, I've got sort of three sort of suggestions. That we start out when we're looking at next steps to talk specifically about sort of action items arising from this workshop. Whether that's the formation of working groups, or, you know, sort of how do we move forward with, you know, with this collaborative exercise that we've kind of began. So I think maybe that's the first thing to consider, and that might take a little while. And then I think we need to, you know, I'm going to suggest, Isabel, if you were able to put up the preliminary agenda for workshop 2 with the various speakers, and I think this is an opportunity to you know, indicate that we have some holes on the agenda, and maybe we will get some volunteers from today, or we might get some ideas on who might present. And then I suggest that we put up the overall schedule, Mark, for the subsequent workshops. And, you know, just to give an idea to people as to the different topics that we will be calling upon, we'll be addressing. And really, I think what we're looking for is suggestions for key speakers, you know, at each of these workshops, and expressions of interest. So we have reached out to some folks. We have some ideas of who we think should be presenting at these workshops, but we don't really understand who's doing exactly what. So anyway, I think if we sort of finish off with maybe that final list of workshops and just try to promote some interest in that before having any sort of closing comments. So that's where I'm at. So maybe you want to turn it over to David Welch, or maybe there's some feedback on these suggestions.
Yeah, so, Jim, I think that's great. And just before we hand it over to David, let's hear some feedback. And I just have a couple of housekeeping items to take care of before we get going. So yeah, just turn that over to everybody else. Thoughts on Jim's flow of events for this afternoon. And Jim, I think that is a pretty good way to approach it. We've been tracking some action items, but certainly want to hear from others and what sort of synthesis that people are doing throughout the process here, and what ideas you're coming up with. So I think some special space for that is great. And then talking about the next workshop, particularly some discussion there about in this workshop, we're not actually looking at those limiting factors in this workshop, so that'll be a key difference towards that next workshop, and we'd just like to set the stage for what that looks like as well, leading into that workshop, and then the review of topics, I think, is a really good idea. We don't have a break built into this afternoon, but recognizing that people probably will need a break at some point, we can play it by ear and see what's natural, but there, I do anticipate that we'll take at least a 10-15 minute.
I'm just going to walk away from my computer for a minute to highlight what it is we're listening to. I've been able to join the Area 25 roundtable, which is DFO and West Coast Aquatic and many different stakeholder groups, and they're working on the WCVI, that's the West Coast Vancouver Island Chinook Rehabilitation Plan. So we're going to keep on listening, but this, you are listening to the Green Antlers Waterfowl Podcast. This is season two, we'll get back to the Chinook and following the fish. So let's see, I think we're close to episode 20 in season two.
Have we gone to
the coast-wide decline of survival and survival of West Coast Chinook salmon by David Welch.
Is it full screen now?
It is, David. We can see fine.
Great. All right. Thanks for the opportunity to present. Jim asked me to sort of briefly go over a paper that we published a year and a half ago now. I want to acknowledge my two co-authors, as we have Border and Aaron Machiski. Aaron is on the call and is now, as many people know, at DFO, and is going to be replacing Wilf in due course when Wilf actually retires, if he does. So the paper we talked about, we're going to talk about and review briefly from the WCVI perspective, is this one. It's open access, and it's available if you just search with Google Scholar. Basically, what we did was we took all of the available government time series of survivals, multi-adult terms, there are 123 for Chinook, from up in the northern part of the Alaska Panhandle down to California. There's about 2,300 years of salmon survival data, you can see on the side. For West Coast Vancouver Island, we labeled it WCVI. But what we're actually talking about is the Robertson Creek coded wire tag survival time series, because that's all that's available for the WCVI Chinook. So what we set out to compare here identify was, or we concluded, was that Chinook SARS are down about 1% coastwide. It's not exactly the same number everywhere, but it's fallen everywhere by rather similar amounts on the longer time series, at least. And the key point here is that WCVI SARS are numerically similar to SAR levels elsewhere. And so the question that comes up is, if all of the populations along the West Coast are falling to a similar low level, how does that happen if they're all occupying different parts of the ocean and obviously different freshwater systems? So here's a slide from NOAA, which I don't actually agree with, but it gives this sort of conceptual idea of where different stocks go out to sea. Mark Trudell and I have a manuscript, which we have not yet turned into a peer-reviewed publication, that really shows from the data that we have collected in the early stages of the high sea salmon program at DFO. The smolts are staying strictly on the continental shelf out to the end of the Alaska Peninsula, at the start of the Bering, of the ocean islands and the Bering Sea, far into the fall and early winter, at least until December. But we haven't published that. The difference here with this slide from NOAA is that it's saying that the animals, all animals, smolts, are staying on the shelf for a long period, much longer than people have thought. Eventually, some of those stocks go off to the open North Pacific, others stay on the shelf, and then the adults migrate back to their natal rivers. So somewhere in there is when survival decline is being determined. It may be at multiple points in the life history that are all going down, or it may be at just one, and I'll come back to that at the end. All right, so here's the data. Really what we're going to talk about today in this 5 minutes is the BSC's coded wire tag survival database, which both the US and Canada had contributed to. I want to lay out just what we're seeing here with this, because you'll see this graph several times. So on the top row, we have the sub-yearlings or the fall Chinook. The bottom row, we have yearlings. I would have preferred to have broken this out by fall and spring Chinook, but the sub-yearling and yearling stage don't necessarily match with that, because many of the hatchery populations of fall Chinook, some of them are holding them to be yearlings to try to boost their survival. So I'm going to focus here on these data sets. Here are the regions going from Southeast Alaska at the north to California in the south, WCBI here. And on each of the panels, you'll see three vertical lines, which are the regime shifts when we know the ocean survival change for salmon, 1977, 1989, and 1998. And then the red line here is the SAR of 1%, survival of 1%. So let's step through just the WCBI. We see a big decline from the first years of the Robertson Creek hatchery operation in the late 70s. Survival was about 4% on average there. The y-axis here, I should mention, on all of these graphs, so this is the same. It's a log axis. So this is a big decline. It goes down from 4% to somewhat less than 1% in more recent years. If we look more broadly though, so the other sub-yearling stocks, Strait of Georgia, you see the same thing, big decline. Puget Sound, big decline. And if we look at yearlings in Southeast Alaska, because there's no sub-yearling stocks up there, we see this similar large decline even in Southeast Alaska. So one of the things that we did to compare them and say, well, just how good or bad are salmon stocks doing along the coast, was to compare their survival with that of the Snake River. Sub-yearlings on the top row, yearlings on the bottom. And what we did was we took the most recent 5 years of the data that were available, and then we compared the survival relative to the Snake River by dividing by the Snake River value. So the Snake River SAR in a given year would be, or this five-year period would be the one, which would be the dashed line. And then the red bars here are the bootstrap confidence intervals on the ratio of survivals. And the surprising thing is that for that five-year period, WCBI, the adult return rates are actually substantially below even what the Snake River had. Even the top 95% confidence interval just barely comes up to equality with the Snake River. We're now working on an additional paper. The results caused some interest. We've identified a couple of issues that need to be addressed in a new paper that we're just working on. Basically, one of the criticisms of the original work was that if we just take a five-year period, maybe distortions in the sampling between the Snake River and the other regions that we compare it to possibly would consider causing some sort of a distortion. So we considered the ratio of survivals to the Snake relative to the Snake River, breaking it down year by year. What's nice about that is that allows us to track the relative survival trends relative to the Snake River over time, as far back as the records go. And so here's the sub-yearling for all of these regions. I won't get into it in this talk. Here are the yearlings with Alaska up here. There's a lot to talk about, but we're not going to get into it here. The blue rectangles are the 5 years that we compared in the prior slide. And here's the WCBI results relative to the Snake River, compared on an annual basis. And what's important here is that back in 1985, for example, Robertson Creek survivals were 10 times better than Snake River survivals in the same year. But in the most recent years that we have data, it's kicked up a little bit, as Will Fitz pointed out yesterday. But in the 2010-2014 period, it was down at about much less than 1%. It was down at about 1/6 or 1/7 of what the Snake River value is. So these are, because it's on a log scale, these, what apparently small changes, are actually very profoundly large in terms of relative performance. So that's a big change. You know, we're talking about something that's gone from 10 times better to about 1/6 as good. So a 60-fold decrease in relative performance. And of course, the question then is, why? What's happening? And where is this happening in the ocean? So this is the next part of the talk, to try to focus all of us on some of the discussion points. So coastwide, both the spring stream type and fall ocean type Chinook have both fallen substantially. It's not just a WCBI problem, and it's not just a BC problem. So, you know, my own view on this is we need to look for the survival drivers that affect all regions of the coast and both life history types, because we're looking for some commonalities here. So the first one is that it can't be freshwater habitat impacts that are the largest driver. I'm not saying that that doesn't mean that they're not important. It just means that they can't be the big driver of this coastwide decrease. So the two points here are the wild Southeast Alaska SARS have decreased, which I haven't talked about, but it's in the paper. And the habitat, freshwater habitat in that region is essentially pristine. But also Southeast Alaska hatchery SARS, because of the way the Alaskans release them, they're released right into the ocean. There's no freshwater staging. And those have decreased a lot as well. So it seems to be truly something happening in the marine phase. So where does that take us? Well, as I mentioned just before lunch, I think we need to move from talking about mortality and the numbers dying to the survival. And we can break it out in this sort of conceptual stage of smolts the first few weeks or months in the ocean, juveniles the rest of the, say, to the end of the summer, juvenile survival through the remainder of age one, times the survival in age two, times the survival in age three, times the survival at age four for fall Chinook subyearlings. For spring Chinook, it's a similar equation, but they have spent a full year in freshwater before they go to sea, so it's age four is missing. So what's common here? Well, downriver and for migration at first few months in the ocean, that survival is common for both of them. And the adult coastal return is happening at age four for the fall Chinook and age three for the spring Chinook. The fall Chinook are spending 3 years apparently on the continental shelf where there's heavy fish, or formerly heavy fisheries on them. And the spring Chinook, at least for some of them, are true offshore populations that spend those 2 years out at sea far offshore. So since both fall and spring Chinook have large decreases in survival, I take it that the offshore period is not where the major decline in survival over time occurs, because we're seeing it for both life history types and all of these regions of the coast. So to me, that suggests that there could be shelf-focused predation as the main cause of the decrease in SARS, because these are, that's common for the adult coastal return. It's also common for the juveniles migrating up the shelf. Now, we normally think of these animals as the primary culprits, but I want to point out this paper that was published in 2010, where the authors discovered a big concentration of sharks, salmon sharks and blue sharks, just off the southern tip of Haida Gwaii. And their estimate was that there were 20,000 sharks of all species combined just in the surface area. So this is an area where returning adults have to migrate past as they migrate down the coast. And as the paper says, neither statistical method accounted for submerged sharks. So that's that estimate of 20,000 sharks congregating there is an underestimate of the abundance of the sharks. So my point is, it's not just a pinniped problem It's not just an increase in pinnipeds over time that could be causing a lot of the losses that we see as failure of adults to come back, but it could also be sharks and other cold water predators, cold-blooded predators as well. So, in summary, coastwide decline in the SARS to similar low levels could be explained by increasing coastal predation rates. I'm throwing that out as an idea. What I like about this is that the predation by predators on adults returning maturing salmon provides a possible explanation for why the southern populations of salmon do not have even lower SARS than the northern populations like Southeast Alaska, despite the southern smolts having to swim farther north. It's something that's always puzzled me is why, if the smolts are swimming north through poor survival conditions, why don't they have much lower survival relative to the more northern populations? And this, if it's focused on the adults returning, this may be an explanation for it, because the predation losses or the survival losses may be occurring in the coastal zone on the adults. So I'll open it up for questions then.
I have a question. If I could ask one, it'd be great. Very
interesting.
Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. So the obvious question, I'm sure you've thought about this, is whether you have the data to see whether the H1 and the H2 also saw that big drop, to narrow it even down, more down to at which phase we see the big loss.
There is potentially the data to look at some of that, because jack returns in some years have been good indicators of what the other ages will subsequently return at, but they haven't been very good indicators, I think. So that might suggest that predation on after the jack stage, the H1s, may actually be significant. But that's all I can really comment on. I don't know if others have better idea of the jack data or how it might be used than that general comment.
Just thinking that the micro trolling program, at least provide trends too, if it's carried out over enough years, a long enough period.
I think a variety of those techniques can be used together to identify what the survival is in various periods, sections of the segments of the overall life history. And my own guess is that there isn't a critical period, there isn't a silver bullet that if we just study one particular period, we're necessarily going to get it. Get 90% of the survival problem determined there. But if the adults the maturing adults that are migrating back in are where there's significant losses, that could potentially be addressed through dealing with predators in some ways if that happens. Lots of political questions around that, of course, so I'm just talking about it from a scientific perspective.
Okay, thanks for the question, Omer. Yuri, then Kaden.
Oh, yes, David, thank you. That's a great presentation and very compelling results. My question is this. So if your explanation is that mortality, or much of it, happens at the terminal stage, whereby adults are predated upon by various predators, would you not expect the same or similar type of survival pattern in the other species of Pacific salmon? And if you do, what's the actual, if somebody could comment on the actual trends in those survival rates.
Well, the first version of the paper that we did, we had steelhead in there as well. So we had steelhead data from the Columbia Basin up to northern Vancouver Island, Keel River, which is Port Hardy. And the steelhead patterns are, you know, essentially the same. So that would support it. I suspect that if we could find a time to pull the coho data together, we might see the same thing. I'm not sure that it's necessarily true for coho from Southeast Alaska, but that may be associated with their migration pattern being different as well. But I can't comment on coho because I haven't, you know, somebody needs to do a systematic analysis the way we did to really nail it down, I think, for coho. And I doubt the data exists to do it for sockeye, but maybe someone can comment. Sockeye might be amenable to the same sort of analysis if the data can be extracted, but I kind of doubt that it isn't, because coded wire tagging of sockeye really hasn't happened.
Okay, thanks for the question, Yuri. Kaden?
Yeah, just kind of a more of like a forward-thinking question. Is predation decline more or less a symptom of the current condition of depressed salmon stocks, considering they've always existed historically? And, yeah.
My understanding is that pinnipeds have increased about a factor of 5 in abundance.
After the 1960 seals call, yes, they have been. But salmon populations weren't inherently depressed previous to the 60s fishing.
Actually, they'd kicked up a fair bit in the 60s. Early 1950s was a period of very low salmon abundance. So, if we take that sort of longer perspective over a century, salmon populations have gone up and down, obviously. But if you stretch it back, I know that the early 50s, Bill Ricker was publishing on the large size of the salmon starting about then, but that large size of those salmon was associated with a time of low salmon abundances. Carol, you've got your hand up. Caden, did you want to carry on? Sorry, Carol. Caden, did you want to carry on the conversation?
It gives me something to think about. I forgot about the early 50-55 stuff, so.
Okay.
We'll look into it.
Carol?
Yeah, I just want to add some food for thought on this topic, and that is, I've grown Chinook at a hatchery situation for 40 years. And in 2011, we released yearling Chinook into Sarita, Nament River, and Phillips River. The marine survival for Sarita and Nament were greater than 5%. And the Phillips River, I believe that first release in 2011 was 8%. Washington Auditor has also done a report in, I think it was 92, and they assessed 25 hatcheries who grew S0s and S1s. And because marine survival is largely dependent on hatchery process, how you grow the fish, and what the eventual survivals will be. And when I attended the Northwest Fish Culture Conference in 2019 and I gave a presentation on our results, what I noticed with Washington or the U.S., and they produce a lot of fish. Hatchery practices are intensive culture, growing a lot of fish in an intensive situation, which is, it's great for production, but in a lot of cases, it's not conducive for producing the best fish. So we have a program in our hatchery that we design, and like I say, when we released fish in the Mint Sarita, which are West Coast streams, as well as Phillips, we had substantially greater marine survivals and few jacks and older six-year-old returns. And I think we're looking at the ocean, but we need to start looking a bit more at hatchery process, incubators, intensive culture pathogens, and that sort of stuff. And you will find a solution, because we did 4 releases in a 5-year period in Phillips River, which has now increased to 3,500 fish. So, and they're no longer enhancing that stream. So we gotta, you know, that's just food for thought. Is it the ocean? Is it this? Maybe we should be looking back at the hatching practices.
If I can, you know, comment, Carol's right that hatchery practices play a role, because if we can boost hatchery survival, that's going to play through to improved adult returns. But it's happening coast-wide. The paper goes into the comparison more of or breaking out the hatchery versus wild. If I can share my screen, let's see if people can see this. See if I can just increase this. All right. Can people see the my screen again?
Yeah, we can. David?
I'm just going to go back to this. I can't zoom in on this, unfortunately, but if you look at my cursor for the yearlings, here's the Southeast Alaska population, and this is the hatchery reduction in survival over time, and the wild population in the dashed line. So the interesting thing is even the hatchery production, which has been pretty standardized, has gone down by a factor of, I'm eyeballing it, a quarter. Survival's a quarter of what it was. And in the last 20 years or so, it's pretty well parallel to the wild decline. So whatever's happening here is the hatchery populations actually have higher survival than the wild populations do, but that makes sense because they've been protected for part of the life history. But there's this decrease, and again, this is on a log scale. You know, each of these tick marks here is a factor of 4 difference in survival. So something's happening in the marine phase here. I'm not disagreeing with Carol that the hatchery practices can be improved. I think they can. I think she's on to something with what she's suggesting. But there's also big declines in the ocean, and we don't understand why yet. But it's happening up in Southeast Alaska as well.
Yeah, thanks, David. And Carol, I can see you've got your hand up there again, and I appreciate the value of speaking about hatchery practices here. But again, I've got to bring this back into the context of the focus of this workshop, and we're getting derailed into hatchery practice conversations quite a bit. That again is we've got some parking lots for those in other workshops, and we have the opportunity now to focus on some oceans conversations. So, I'd like to bring us back there for now.
Could I just say one more comment? Is the hatchery practice and the quality is declining because we have increased temperatures from global warming, and so now you're having pathogens and other issues increasing in that setting. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Carol. David, I was noticing Will's question here in the chat and just wanted to bring that forward. I thought it was a good one. David, do you think the high abundance of Bristol Bay sockeye or Southeast Alaska or Russian pink and chum could be fueling an increase in salmon shark populations? What do you know about their diet? How movements overlap with different species from different geographic regions? All in one answer.
Do I get 5 seconds or 10 seconds to give a complete answer?
Right.
Salmon sharks, I'm guessing, have a 10 to 15 year life. Lifespan at least. So it's not something that suddenly changes, but it may be on the same time scale that pinniped populations increase as well. So I think this is the whole ocean. We need to keep a fairly wide perspective on what's happening. I think
seals and sea lions are part of the ecosystem. That it's no surprise they eat fish. Everything eats fish, basically, that's a little bigger. But we want to look at, you know, we don't want to just focus in and say, oh, well, it's seals or it's sea lions or it's salmon sharks. I think they all play some role in this. What we, I think, would be most valuable is if we can identify how much of the survival is occurring, the whole survival process is occurring in the first year of the marine life history and the last year of the life history. Then you can start partitioning it down into the component parts. You know, in past years they've talked about hake as you know, salmon small predators and so on. You know, I'm sure there's no question that they act as predators. What we really need to do is identify why have we got a fourfold decrease or more in survival over time, over the decades, and what are the contributors to it. I think it's probably multifaceted, but if we can identify some parts of it as important and possibly subject to management actions, then we've gone some way towards it. But the, you know, the broader perspective, you know, given what the global warming models are predicting in the next 2 to 3 decades, is it's going to be really bleak for salmon because they're cold water fish that are moving into a warmer and warmer ocean over time. So we need to bear that in mind too, so that we're not over promising what we can deliver. In terms of returns with the world continuing to change and CO2 levels rising.
Great, thanks, David. Kaden?
Thank you, David. That little topic of discussion kind of spurred this question. Would it be apt to say or suggest that maybe when we're, and I'm a manager, so excuse me for the boringness of my thought paths, would it be apt to include increased in predation populations into calculations to making sure when we are doing our harvest management or dealing with kind of tools in that sense, that we're accounting for that decline in a way until we can find better ways to manage and address those kind of bedsides? I'm trying to think of immediate action to, you know, help increase returns. So right now, most in terms of
I think it would be really useful to do that exercise, because I think you're going to start identifying some of the data gaps where you're you can't do it because of certain things that you don't know. I don't think you're necessarily that far away from being able to do it now. Certainly conceptually you can do it, and then you'd identify pretty quickly what things you'd want to know better to tighten up those calculations.
Thank you. Great, thanks. And David, I just have a quick question. You know, we're following up on Jim's comment about getting lists for experts. We do have a workshop coming up on predation. Who might you recommend as an animal expert that relates to your research that we might be able to bring to that workshop?
You want somebody that's a shark expert, Ken Gold.
Somebody shark.
Sorry?
That somebody sharky, yes.
Yeah, Ken Goldman up at Alaska Department of Fish and Game immediately springs to mind.
Okay.
I can give you contact information if you don't have it. You have to think a bit more about it. You know.
It's
Aaron, Mark, and David. What about Andy Seitz?
Yeah, actually, Andy presenting on some of his telemetry work, tagging work on Chinook relative to that. Ken Goldman, as I recall, was a co-author with him. Ken's the salmon shark expert, who was, but Andy certainly would be an interesting one from the Chinook predation perspective, too.
Great, thanks, David. Got that noted. Wolf, and then Jim.
Yeah, thanks. Don't dispute your hypothesis for the sharks, and so that's really great to understand some more of those pieces. So the end part is good. The front part, where you're showing that some of the stuff on the screens here, there's a lot of variation within, even in this, like the Strait of Georgia and the WCBI, Puget Sound, where are those fish going? You know, Fraser's 4-1s from the upper Fraser are doing great. Cowchin are doing great. Other ones are not so much. They all have different, very different places that they're going in the ocean.
Yes.
It's to some extent, your lumping is kind of concerning to me. And there's also parts like, you know, they enter the ocean, stream type fish, yearlings enter the ocean in a different year than freshwater fish or the ocean type fish. So all those little nuances are, that's where I think we can learn from it. And so I'm worried a bit about it as making general conclusions, well, that it can't be the ocean. And part of it is, I don't know how many of it, and we don't know how many. I'm going to take the screen for a second. Oh, I can't. You could stop sharing and just look at what the oceanographers down in the southern U.S. provide us. And I think it correlates really well with what your some of those trends you're seeing. So this they have these set of ocean indicators from the Northwest Pacific, yep. You know, often off the northwest part of the southern U.S. And those dips that you've indicated are really part of this, where you see there's a lot of red, and that's 2014 to 15, 16, all this period here. And so that there is a general pattern that ocean conditions are local and broader, like PDO and other stuff that could be dealing with this. And so the idea that it's not early marine, it's more late marine, I think that's a bit of a stretch still.
Oh, I'm not saying it is. I'm throwing out that the idea that we shouldn't assume it's early marine necessarily. And if it's my and the other part of my point that I didn't clarify enough is that if it's later marine, I think we've got a better shot at being potentially able to manipulate the drivers of those reduced survivals in the adult phase relative to the small phase. Whether that's true or not, that's science needs to be done to answer that question and quantify it and answer the question. But if it's as your ocean indicator stop light chart here indicates, let's say it's good copepod abundance, they've got more fat, more oil, the smolts feed better. We don't have any control on that potentially. Now, I'm not saying that's not important. I'm saying that that's not something that we could potentially manipulate to improve adult returns, which is what we need. But if even if the copepod abundance, southern versus northern copepods or zooplankton was the biggest driver, if the predator feeding on adults coming and maturing adults coming back in was only a third as important, well, that is something that potentially can be under control. But lots of issues about whether or not ethically and philosophically we would want to drive those predator populations down enough to improve salmon survival. I'm not even going to go there because we all recognize all of the issues that would come up. But what I am saying is that even if it was only a third as important, it is something that at least in principle is under our control to manage. Now, the first thing to do is figure out if it is a third as important or only a hundredth as important. We just don't know at this point.
Great, thanks, David. Jim?
I just wanted to say that in terms of shark experts, as somebody else pointed out, I see in the chat, Sandy McFarlane is sort of the local shark expert, but he's retired. But Jackie King has a real strong interest in sharks. I don't know if she's got data relevant to this discussion, but she certainly would be somebody to talk to.
Thanks, Jim. Noted those down. And Larry just had a question in the chat. I'm just going to go back here. This is from Larry Johnson. does anyone know how much production the U.S. hatcheries have produced since the 1950s versus Canadian hatcheries production rates during the same period? Would competition of U.S. hatchery production have an impact on our marine survival rate of our salmon out at sea?
Jim Irvine, did you pay to have somebody ask that question for you?
No, I did not, David. In fact, I've been avoiding that. But Larry, we have summarized the hatchery releases, and we have projected returns of hatchery and wild salmon going back to 1926. And I don't have time to go into the details, but I mean, one thing people don't realize is, you know, over the last 15 years, there's been more salmon in the ocean than at any time previously. And certainly, there's more salmon in the ocean now than there was before hatcheries were sort of developed and became efficient in the 1970s. So, but it comes down to what are the species and what are the populations that you're really interested in. So, you know, the ocean ecosystem is dominated from a biomass perspective by chum salmon and numerically by pink salmon. And so they are largely the ones that you know, have an effect on the food chain, and we will get into this in subsequent workshops. I don't want to go into any detail, but it's but there are many publications on this topic. So maybe I'll leave it at that for now.
That sounds good, Jim. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions for David? I know we've kind of gone away from sort of clarification questions. It seems like there was a lot of interest right away, and Jim, I apologize. I was allowing it to go on because it seems like it was front of mind for people right then. But good conversations, and appreciate everybody's comments and questions.
All right,
David,
I can see if I can share my screen, if you like.
Great, sure. Go ahead, Jim.
All right. Can you see that? That's great. It works.
Yeah.
All right. So I'd like to give a short presentation based on some research that that Mike Malik did. And this is kind of linked to the stuff we were talking about yesterday. But so it's essentially on non-stationary drivers of Pacific salmon productivity. Now, if you go to this link right here, this will be left, this will be, the presentation will be available. But the Mike's presentation, which was at a workshop that we had last May, is there, audio and video. So what I've done is simply grabbed some slides from this presentation and adapted it for this audience. Why doesn't it go forward? I see I'm not actually in slideshow.
You're not in slideshow, Jim, but we can see. Okay, if you also just want to scroll down the side here, you can click on the next slide.
All right, I got
on your left.
Okay, so what we're talking about in terms of non-stationary drivers, well, a driver is simply something in the ecosystem that causes an effect. And it could be rainfall, as indicated by this this slide, or what I'm going to be talking about are really horizontal processes, currents and eddies, that kind of thing. But the important thing to understand is that the effects of these drivers on fish, including salmon, are non-stationary. So they vary over time, and they also vary over space.
Jim, if you're talking to slide two, we can only see slide one.
Oh, that's not so good.
Jim, would you like me to bring up your slide presentation, and then I can drive it from here? Would that be helpful?
If you just do slideshow, it should pick it up.
You can see the second slide now, right?
Yes, we can.
All right, I'll just do it this way. So anyway, the point is you have most ecosystem drivers are not stationary in time or space, but a lot of the analyses that are underway assume constant effects of these drivers. So I'm gonna start with the conclusion. I'm gonna give a little bit of detail on how we reached the conclusions, and then on the last slide, we'll show the conclusions again. So what I'm talking about specifically are horizontal ocean processes, which are essentially currents. And so the main conclusion is that these can affect salmon productivity, recruits per spawner, but the effects will vary across space and time. So the example I'm going to use, which is based on Mike Malik's work, is the intensity and location of the North Pacific Current, which we were introduced to yesterday, which is this large conveyor belt of water that travels across the North Pacific. Now, there's been a number of studies which have looked at sort of the effects of this current on productivity of survival pink and chum salmon, but not yet Chinook salmon, as far as I know. And so the final sort of conclusion is that you know, the location of this this point of entry to the West Coast varies by, you know, at least several hundred kilometers interannually. And that if you have a northern location, that this potentially appears to increase salmon productivity by the southward displacement of lipid-rich northern zooplankton. So this is the figure that we saw yesterday. This is a very generalized view. So the North Pacific Current comes across, it bifurcates at some point, splits into the Alaska Current and the California Current. The intensity of these of this major current are largely determined by air pressure in these different gyres. But the location, which is what I'm going to talk about specifically, is really interesting because it can vary by hundreds of kilometers north and south. So the question is, what does this north-south positioning, what impact will this have on salmon productivity? Now, the theory here, and there's no data from a zooplankton perspective that I know of to substantiate it, but the idea is if you have a northward shift in the bifurcation, what this means is that the West Coast ecosystem will be more strongly influenced by southerly flowing California current waters and displacing these large lipid-rich zooplankton of the Gulf of Alaska. So the way I kind of think about this is it's kind of like bears in hibernation. So when bears go into hibernation, they need a lot of fat to get through the winter. So the winter ecosystem in the north tends to be colder. So maybe it's not surprising that the plankton are fatter. They have to get through that winter period. The southern copepods or southern community, well, they're kind of like, I don't know, sleek, svelte Californians. You know, they don't need that extra calories to get through the winter. Now, that's at least that's the way I remember. I don't know if there's any basis others can comment on that. So what Mike did is he used the OSCRS model, and this is simply a current model, and he introduced 215 drifters to this model for each ocean year from 1967 to 2010. And so the idea is you can map the movement of these drifters. So you can think of these drifters as zooplankton. And so the idea is there a difference in the distribution of these zooplankton depending on the location of the bifurcation. So the graph there shows what's called the bifurcation index. And so values, it runs from 1968, I think, to 2010. So we have data on where this bifurcation point hits the coast or hits Western North America. And when the value is above the 0.5 level, that means that there's a northern bifurcation. If it's below the dotted line, dashed line, that means a southern bifurcation. So if we look at 2010, what we have is the bifurcation actually reached North America at about the Washington, Oregon border, I guess a little bit north of that. But the implication of this is that there will be most of these drifters, as you can see from the simulation, are actually migrating north. So this would presumably move these plankton, these California current plankton, up to the north. If we look at the previous year, 2009, this was a year when there was a really northerly bifurcation point. And once again, when you look at the simulation, what you see is increased influence in our area of the west coast of Vancouver Island by the California current, again, presumably transporting some of these planktons to the south. So the kind of interesting thing here is that the area that we're talking about, the west coast of Vancouver Island and north up towards the Charlottes, or sort of Haida Gwaii, is in kind of a transition zone. So depending on this bifurcation point, the zooplankton community is theoretically quite different. Now, I don't have time to go into the data. If you look at Mike's paper or the presentation that I gave linkages to, what he did was some very sophisticated Bayesian modeling, particularly with sockeye, but also pink and chum, and looked at the relationship between this this interannual pattern of bifurcation and the productivity of those populations. By productivity, we're talking recruits per spawner, and found a definite connection. So the question I'm asking is, could this also have an influence on the growth and survival of West Coast Vancouver Island Chinook? Be relatively easy to simply look at the survival or the growth of West Vancouver Island Chinook based on their bifurcation index and see if there's a relationship there. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Oh, this is way over my head, and I'm so glad that we are able to learn about Chinook and the oceans and the pinnipeds and the salmon sharks and you know, the ways in which systems are integrated, because I think that that's the big takeaway for me, is whether they're hatchery fish or wild fish. What Carol said about the ocean heating up is the part that, you know, cold water fish, hot ocean. That's what I am hearing. And this has been the last two days. I've been able to sit in on this day-long workshop about the West Coast, Vancouver Island Chinook. And I've learned a lot of words that I didn't know before. And I also get a sense that there's a lot of really good science being done and data collection, which is super important. But, you know, we can continue to monitor our decreasing salmon stocks. But that, like, how do we make the oceans cold is, I guess, the question that is coming to me. And well, it further is about weather and glaciers and about climate change, of course, right? So I am hoping that it's not the sharks that get blamed, or the hatcheries, you know, or even the fish farms. I feel like there's got to be a more diversified approach, and that's just, you know, my two cents. And I want to thank everyone for listening. This is the Green Antlers Waterfowl Podcast. My name is Sarah Fowler, and you've been listening to the Vancouver Island, West Coast Vancouver Island, the WCVI Chinook workshop for Area 25. Yeah, Area 25. And that is the west coast of Vancouver Island. And where the fish go from here. So we've heard about a little bit about Alaska and about what is happening there. It was interesting to me that they are just putting
the enhanced fish, like the hatchery fish, into the ocean directly without going into sort of a river mouth, because then there's no returning to that same river. It's just sort of like one of the things that I was learned, by doing when before COVID, there was volunteers at the egg take for our local hatchery, was that it's the water that activates it. So you can, you know, have the eggs and the milk and put it together, but it has to be water from that river that sort of creates the homing beacon, or the, you know, work getting it working, it fertilizing, you know. And I have definitely a lot to learn about smolt and fry and salmon.